Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we are discussing sutta number 2 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Sabha Sutta Sutta. And last week I gave explanation of the opening passages in the sutta and some keys for understanding it. And now we come to passage paragraph number 5, in which the Buddha is going to explain the taint to be abandoned by seeing. And as I explained last week, this word seeing in Pali Dasana is a kind of code word, a key word, which indicates the achievement of the stage of dream entry, the first stage of enlightenment, first stage of real, of true realization, or we could call it world transcending realization. And what is distinctive of this stage is that it is the first time that one sees all Four Noble Truths. And one does this by seeing for the first time especially the third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, that is the truth of the unconditioned of nirvana. And once one sees into the heart of the Dhamma, the essence of the Dhamma, then the rest of the task for the three mantra is to cultivate and develop that seeing or that vision to the point of complete liberation. And so this achievement of what's called the path of seeing is like the turning point or breakthrough, the fundamental breakthrough to the ultimate truth of the Dhamma. And then once one reaches that breakthrough, then there's no possibility of turning away from the path of the Dhamma until one achieves final liberation. That is why one who reaches that experience is called a stream enterer. That one has entered the stream of the Dhamma, the stream is the Noble Eightfold Path, the truly noble, the Aryan Noble Eightfold Path. And even if this person is very negligent and lazy, cannot really practice very diligently, but still those factors have taken root in this person and will continue to propel this person on so that the person cannot undergo an eighth existence. In seven more existences, the person will have to achieve full enlightenment and final liberation. And so the Buddha is going to undertake to show what's called the taints or asavas to be abandoned by seeing. And he does so not directly, but in an indirect way. First, well, he raises the question, what are the taints that should be abandoned by seeing? But instead of just answering the question directly, he, in a sense, you could say, he turns the teaching back by showing or establishing a contrast with a contrast between the ordinary person and who doesn't make any effort to abandon the taint. And then, in contrast, he will show the noble disciple who does abandon certain taints by sin. And here, the Buddha introduces a distinction which is very fundamental to the suttas. It runs right through all of the suttas. This is a distinction between what is called, rather unflatteringly, the uninstructed, ordinary person. In Pali, the asuttava kutujana. We'll come to the instructed noble disciple later. But we have a standard description of the, here it's described as the untaught ordinary person in the translation of Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses. I translate it as the, I now prefer that translation, the uninstructed worldling. In the commentaries, they refer to this type of person as the Andaputujana Vasta Nisito Andaputujana, the blind worldling attached to the round of existence, attached to samsara. And we have a standard description of this type of person. This is a person, it's given in the text right here, who has no regard for noble ones. The noble ones are the Aryans, the spiritually noble ones, and who is unskilled in their, who is unskilled in their Dharma and untrained in their Dharma. Okay, to say he is unskilled or unexperienced in their Dharma, this is taken to imply that he has no knowledge of the teaching, no understanding of the teaching. And then he is undisciplined in their Dhamma. Arya Dhamme Avinito. He is undisciplined in the noble Dhamma. That is, means he lacks practical training in the teaching of the noble ones. And then the same thing is restated in terms of Sapurisa. Here, following Yanamoli, I use true men, but in Connected Discourses, I made it gender neutral and said superior person, we'll use that rendering, who has no regard for superior persons. The superior person is the same as the noble one, who is unskilled in the Dhamma, the teaching of the superior person, and is undisciplined in the Dhamma of the superior person. Okay, this person, that is the standard description of the uninstructed worldling. Then, stemming off from that description, many things in different suttas are said about the uninstructed worldling. Here, what is said is that this person does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. He doesn't understand what things should be attended to. And here I think attention is maybe too narrow a rendering. What things should be considered? What things should be turned over in the mind? And he does not understand what things should not be considered, what things should not be turned over in the mind. Since that is, but we'll stick to the rendering here, since that is so, he attends to those things that are unfit for attention, and he does not attend to those things that are fit for attention. Now the commentary makes the point, since I pointed it out, in note 36, the commentary makes the important point that there is no fixed determination in things themselves as to whether they are fit or unfit for attention. The distinction consists rather in the mode of attention. That mode of attention that is a causal basis for unwholesome states of mind should be avoided, while that mode of attention that is a causal basis for a wholesome state should be developed. I'm not quite sure that I would agree with this now. Since it seems that there are certain things, at any rate, that we could say can be strong conditions for the arising of the sense. But there is a certain truth in what the commentary says, and if one has developed one's wisdom, mindfulness, wisdom, insight to a certain degree, then one could attend to things that are ordinarily conditions for the arising of defilements in undeveloped people, and those things will not be conditions for the arising of defilements. But in fact, one can use those considerations to develop a certain detachment or disenchantment with the things that people ordinarily become attached to. But still, I want to go into paragraph 6. I think when I explain, we'll see that there are certain things which are rather strong conditions for certain things. Okay, continuing, this is a kind of elaboration of the previous paragraph. What are the things unfit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen pain of sensual desire arises in him, and the arisen pain of sensual desire increases. The unarisen pain of being arises in him. Now I would say the unarisen pain of craving for existence. That is what it really means. The unarisen pain of craving for existence arises in him, and the arisen pain of craving for existence increases. The unarisen pain of ignorance arises in him, and the arisen pain of ignorance increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he attends to. Okay, so what are these things? And notice it's important to also consider that for each of these pains, the Buddha says that when one attends to these things wrongly, unarisen pains increase, or unarisen pains arise, and arisen pains increase. This is an important distinction because there can be one can be in a state where a particular pain, particular defilement, it's not yet abandoned or eradicated, but it might be lying in a state of quiescence. One might have achieved some success in subduing it. But then, if one attends to certain things that are not fit to be attended to, things that are naturally provocative of the taint, then that taint that's subdued, that's been suppressed, will have the opportunity to arise. And then it might be that taints that are still relatively active in one's mind, that there are taints that are still relatively active in one's mind, defilements that continue to come up from time to time. And if one is wise, if one really wants to overcome them, then one will avoid things that provoke them. But if one doesn't avoid those things, if one continues to attend to them, then those pains that have already arisen will just become stronger to the point that they overpower you. And so what are the specific things that are the strong conditions for these pains? Okay, for the taint of sensual desire, here there are so many texts in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 35, Dalayasana Samyutta, many sutras in which the Buddha says, he speaks about the five kama gunas, the five cores of sensual desire, the five objects of sensual pleasure. Also in this Majjhima Nikaya, we find this in sutta number 13. Number 13, paragraph 7, page 180. There are forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Similarly, there are sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, tastes or flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangible, tactile objects cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. And then in the Samyutta Nikaya, again and again the Buddha says, he's speaking about a monk, as if a monk, seeks delight in them, welcomes them, and continues to cling to them, and then once again, then he is bound by the bondage of Mara. Mara is the evil one. Or then he is caught by the fisherman's bait, caught by the bait of Mara. Or in other sutras, also this is in Samyutta Nikaya, Nidana Samyutta, chapter 12, and sutra in the 50s, 53, 54, in that range. The Buddha says, when one dwells contemplating or perceiving gratification or pleasure in things that can bind one, then craving arises and increases. When craving arises and increases, then clinging arises. And so from clinging, then all of the other factors in bondage arise. And so in this way, we can say that wrongly attending to the five cords, the five objects of sensual desire, the five, they're called the five cords, like a thread, five threads of sensual pleasure, this is the strong condition for the arising of the asava, the influence, the influx of sensual desire. And now, underlying the arising of this particular asava, there are certain distortions of perception. And I would connect each of the asavas with a particular distortion of perception. In the suttas, particularly it's the sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of Fours, not the number of the information. The Buddha speaks about four distortions of perception. Okay, two of these I'll mention in connection to the arising of the pains of sensual desire. One is the distortion of perceiving as pleasant or pleasurable what is actually, when examined deeply, what is actually unpleasurable. What is really dukkha, perceiving dukkha, pleasure, happiness, in what is really dukkha, what is a cause of unhappiness, perhaps of suffering, or a cause of bondage. The second distortion involved is a distortion of perceiving as attractive, as lovely, what is really unattractive, unlovely. So we have these two distortions underlying the arising of sensual, the pains of sensual desire. Then, the pain, okay, so,
please give me my voice.
Okay, so there are these two distortions involved here. I use the word stressful, but to say suffering is a little too strong. Perceiving what is the cause of suffering, what is, to say stressful, perceiving what is stressful, painful, miserable, as pleasurable, that is the one distortion of perception, and perceiving the unattractive, what is asubha, unlovely, as attractive, as lovely, that is the other distortion. And these two distortions are strong conditions for the arising of this taint or influence, mental influence of sensual desire. Now we come to the asava of, or above asava, the influence or taint of craving for existence. And this is the craving especially for continued existence, the desire to go on existing. And what usually underlies this desire is, well, this desire takes the form of yearning for eternal life in some mode, especially yearning for eternal life in some heavenly world, believing after death one goes to heaven and will live there forever in heaven, and one has a strong craving for this eternal existence in heaven, for believing that there's some kind of superior state, exalted state of consciousness, exalted state of mind, an eternal mind, everlasting mind, that one can merge into and achieve, and then that will last forever. For one achieves some superior meditative attainment, like some samadhi, and then one takes that to be some eternal, everlasting, at least that one believes this is giving one access to some eternal, everlasting state of existence. Also, there's above asapa, there's this kind of very raw, fundamental above asapa, the clinging to existence without any such intellectualized view. But usually, the above asapa takes the form, usually it gives rise to these views of some type of eternal existence. And so what is that there's a particular distortion of perception that underlies this type of craving. And what is that distortion of perception? What is it? Exactly. It's taking what is really impermanent, anicca, to be permanent, nitya. So this gives rise to what is called in Pali, Satsatabhava, eternal refuge. Chang Jian, Chang Hang Jian. See the translators. Chang Hang Lun, Chang Hang Lun. Okay, then we come to the most fundamental of the asapas, and this is the taint or influence or influx of ignorance. And what is it that one attends to unwisely for ignorance, to unarisen ignorance to arise, and arisen ignorance to become stronger? At a gross level, so I would distinguish two levels at which ignorance occurs. First, the grosser level, what you might call the more intellectualized level, more conceptual level. One clings to belief systems, philosophical system, religious system, that affirm the idea of an eternal self, a true self. We're told that at the core of our being there is some inner essence that is indestructible, that is the true I, what I really am underneath all of the appearances, phenomenal appearances. Sometimes, in some systems, it will be the finite individual I, maybe created by an almighty, powerful God, because there's many individual I's, many individual selves. In other belief systems, there will be one universal self, and all of us individually, we are just like little sparks from the fire of the one universal self, or all of our distinctions, divisions, is illusion, underneath this illusion of multiplicity, of difference, there is the one universal self. That is what I call the intellectualized form of ignorance, and more fundamental is what I would call non-conceptual ignorance, or even we could call it instinctive ignorance. And this is just the simple clinging to the idea of a real I. Thinking of things in terms of I and mine. Even if one is not forming a belief system about an eternal self. Okay, and what is the distortion of perception that lies behind this type of ignorance? Or that lies behind ignorance, whether it's gross or subtle? Speak loudly. Exactly. Okay, the distortion is perceiving what is not self as self. Now, in the Abhidhamma and commentaries, a fourth asava or taint is mentioned. This is called, did I mention this last week? Dityasava? This is called the taint of view. Dit-asava, that's because of Sunday, so it's actually Ditti-asava. Ditti-asava. It's the taint or influx of view. We could actually consider that to be the kind of byproduct of ignorance of avidya. Actually, view derives from all three of the primary taints. But it seems ignorance is the strong condition for the arising of the taint of view. I'm just using them as identical, but that's a different question from the question whether there's a relation between, maybe your question is whether there's a difference between saying there is no self and saying things are non-self. That I will come to a little later. Yeah. Look and tell you. What the... I call this non-conceptual ignorance or instinctual ignorance. That is just clinging to things as being the natural arising of the idea, I, mine, taking things to be I and mine. And it's just attending to things in terms of I and mine without forming intellectual theories around the notion of I. Okay, then the Buddha says, you're still in paragraph 6, middle of paragraph, and what are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise, etc. The unarisen taint of being or craving for existence does not arise. The unarisen taint of ignorance does not arise, and the arisen taint of ignorance is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to. And what are these things? and say that they're not things in a separate class of their own, but they are, say, the five aggregates, the six sense faces, the 6 to 12 sense faces, the 18 elements, dependent origination, 4 noble truths, 3 characteristics of existence, all of those things, the principles of the true Dhamma. Okay, at this point, maybe I'll ask if there are any questions on this rather dense passage. Yes. I was explaining in paragraph 6, the Buddha raises a question, this is 1 to 3 of those 10 lines down. What are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, then he just senses the unarisen pain. Each of the unarisen pain does not arise in him, and the arisen pains are abandoned. Those are things fit for attention, yeah. This is bringing it down to a more specific, narrow focus, but I think the way I explained is appropriate in relation to the arising of all of the things. The Buddha brings in this particular development in paragraph 7 and 8 because he wants to show the fetters that are to be abandoned by the noble disciple. And so he brings in paragraph 7, this is the fetter of doubt. In paragraph 8, this is the arising of view of self. But I think we have to understand how the taints arise in a far wider sense than that. So I gave what I would call a comprehensive or global explanation of how the things arise. Maybe not completely comprehensive, but the wider explanation. Say any. It's not mentioned in the sutras, but it's introduced in the Abhidhamma as a separate thing, and I want to explain that it arises specifically, I would say, from the taint of ignorance. I want to trace it to each of the other taints. And then the commentary will, because the Buddha is going to speak about taints that should be abandoned by seeing, but in fact, the things that are abandoned are technically not asadas or taints, according to the system of 3 taints, but 2 of them are taints. If you take the taint, 2 of them could be included under the taint of views, but 2 of them are types of wrong views. Okay, now the Buddha, to show how the worldling attends unwisely, he's going to take a particular type of unwise attention or unwise consideration. And this is the unwise considerations which are governed by doubt or perplexity. And this is technically, this is called the 16-fold doubt. And so he attends unwisely. First he questions, was I in the past? Did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? Okay, the two main alternatives. Then, if he comes to the conclusion that he existed in the past, then he will raise the question, what was I in the past? Was I a human being? God, the deva, an animal, a demon maybe. If I was a human being, was I a king, or just a common worker? How was I in the past? What was my mode of life? Was I living under favorable conditions, unfavorable conditions? Did I enjoy life? Did I suffer a lot? Then having been washed, what did I become in the past? That is, having gone from one life in the past to the next life in the past, what did I become in the life after that? So there's five doubts or perplexities about the past. Five doubts about the future. Shall I be in the future? Will I exist in the future? Or shall I not be in the future? Those are the two main alternatives. Then if he comes to the conclusion that he will exist in the future, then he raises the question, what shall I be in the future? Will I be a human being, a god, or a hell being? If I'm going to be a human being, will I be a king, an ordinary person, a man, a woman? What will I be? How shall I be in the future? What will my conditions of life be in the future? And having been what shall I become in the future? What will I be in the life after that future life? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. He's so confused now. John Hutu. Really confused. He doesn't even know, do I exist? Am I? Do I exist? Maybe I don't exist. This is maybe like Descartes thinking. How can I prove my existence? What am I? Doesn't even know what he is. How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So all of these questions are disturbing. And it seems to me that in this doubt, or in all of these doubts, there are two aspects. Strangely, the commentary doesn't bring out these two aspects, but this is what I would see in them. One is, well, primarily doubt about past and future existences. So also there's doubt about even the present existence, whether we exist at present. But mainly doubt whether there's a past existence and a future existence. And then the other key point is that these doubts are all formulated in terms of what? It's not yet self. That idea of self is still not yet come to the surface, but in terms of what? I heard it. I. Still taking the I to be something real, but not yet turned into a doctrine of self. There's a difference here. It's when the I gets, when takes the I appears in reflection, and one just accepts that I that appears, and then one reflects on it and tries to give it some, call it a conceptual identity. When you give conceptual identity to the spontaneous notion of I, that becomes the idea of self. So there's a subtle distinction here between the spontaneous notion of I am and the idea of self. Specifically, the distinction between the notion I am and the idea of self. I would say the idea I am is something that arises spontaneously due to ignorance. And when the idea of I am is grasped as something valid, something genuine, and then one tries to figure out what is this I that appears, and one arrives at some way of conceiving that apparent I. One gives it a conceptual identity, and that conceptually identified I, that becomes self. It's a little bit like the I am is like the thief stalking in the alley in the darkness. Then it's like the cop grabs that thief, bring him to the police station, and then take a photograph of him with an identifying number and put him in the cell. That becomes self. He now has an identity. Let's see if we can get through this world inspection. Oh, now the important thing is that, the important point is that what leads to the abandoning of the 16-fold doubt? The answer is given in Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 12, sutta number 20. So nicely translated by Mr. Swang in the collection. It is at the very end of that sutta when sutta number Samyutta Nikaya chapter 12, sutta number 20, when a noble disciple has clearly seen with proper wisdom, with correct wisdom, dependent origination, and dependently arisen phenomena, then he cannot entertain any of these 16 doubts. And the text then, the sutta then goes through each of these 16 doubts And it says that the noble disciple has abandoned all of these mountains. Because when the disciple sees with correct wisdom dependent origination and dependently arisen state, dependently arisen phenomena, then he has complete clarity about the existence of past, present, and future lives. But at the same time, when one sees dependent origination correctly, the idea of an I, of a self, or of an I, the true I, undergoing this process of migration from life to life, that idea collapses and disappears. And so all that remains in the, for the wisdom, for the insight of the noble disciple, is this law of dependent origination governing the arising and passing away of dependently originated phenomena. And so one sees that through conditions of the past, present state, present phenomena arise, but the phenomena, the causes, the conditions of the past are not self. The present phenomena are not self. The causal or conditioning factors of the present will condition the arising of state existences in the future, but these conditions are not self, and the effects that arise from them are not self. Okay, let us continue, even though it takes a little more time to finish the world. Comment to paragraph 8. Okay, now because the worldling is now caught up in these speculations and or in these doubts and perplexities, then a state of doubt and perplexity is something very unsatisfying, very disturbing. And so eventually one has to come to some resolution of these doubts. And one does so by formulating a view. A view of self. And so, the Buddha says, one of six views arises in him. Okay, the view, self exists for me. Arises in him as true and discovered. Okay, or the view, no self exists to me, arises in him as true and established. Okay, this is the point that Dr. O asked about before. Now, the Buddha actually doesn't teach there is no self, so his doctrine is commonly explained that way. What he says is that Sabbe Dhamma Anatta, that all phenomena are not self. And there's a subtle distinction. When you say there is no self, that's like taking a position. There is not a self. It's like denying the existence of something. But what, and it's a denial that doesn't really lead to insight. What the Buddha says again and again is all things are not self, which is a way of stating the position that leads to insight. Because naturally, one, through the instinctual working of ignorance, one identifies things as self. One takes things to be oneself. And what one has to do is to, what the Buddha instructs one to do is to investigate these things that one is identifying as self, that one is holding to yourself, in order to see that the way one is perceiving them, the way one is interpreting them is incorrect, a false. And so when one investigates the object of one's grasping, of one's claim, then one sees that these things cannot be identified as self, then one gives up that false identification. But to say there is no self doesn't lead to that relinquishment. In fact, the doctrine, no self exists for me, in the Buddha's time, this was the doctrine of the annihilation. Okay, now for those who hold that there is a self, now we have four, or at least three ways in which this view of self gets refined or formulated. This is a little difficult. Okay, this is really, I think this topic is made for philosophy majors. Because when you thought, this is the whole history of Western philosophy, Indian philosophy, when you start with the idea of self, then you have to figure out what is that self. And then one starts reflecting on one's own experience. And then when you're reflecting on one's own experience, one sees that there's a kind of division in experience between that which is looking and that at which one is looking. This is what reflection means. One is introducing a division in experience between, well, the subjective portion and the objective portion. But the object here is not out there, but it's in here. One is looking at one's own mind, observing oneself. Okay, so there's the observer and the observed. And then the question is, what part of this dichotomy, this duality, is one going to identify itself? And so some philosophers will come up with the idea that both parts are self. You could say the observer is the self, and what is observed is the self. When you're looking into your own mind, there's one part, sort of the conscious part, looking at the mind, and then there's all of the thoughts, images, feelings, emotions that come into the mind. You could say that is also the self. You say the self has two aspects. No, not two selves. There's one self, but two aspects, two dimensions. You can't have two selves. You can have only one self. No, it doesn't. It's quite sensible. You just say that the perceiving portion of oneself, you say, the person is one unitary self, and that self is able to observe itself. So we have the observing portion and the observed portion. Okay, so the first thinker comes to the conclusion that there's the one unitary self, and both with two sides, two aspects. It's like the coin, you have head and tail, two sides of the coin, head side, tail side. But then when he writes his masterpiece, gets it published, some other professor of philosophy in the university reads that and says, that theory full of holes, full of flaws. And he goes to his study, he writes his book proving only the perceiving portion is self, only the observer is self. How could the observed be self? The observed, that's always changing, right? Always different thoughts, different feelings, different emotions, but that conscious awareness that's always just without any content observing them, that is colorless, featureless, no change at all of the consciousness. So then he goes back to his studies, writes his volume, first three chapters dedicated to a refutation of Professor X's book, and then chapters 4 to 20, very eloquently, he sets forth his own theory, sends it off to the press, gets it published. Then all of the reviews come in favorable, praising him, great philosopher, wonderful, brilliant, outstanding. Till one of his students, who's now coming up in the world of philosophy, now wants to make a name for himself. Thinks, well, I learned a lot from my teacher. I'm very grateful to him. But he got it upside down. And so he tries first writing letters to his teacher, trying to express his views. His teacher gets a little angry and tries to insist, you have to understand it my way. But the pupil won't accept that. And finally, the pupil thinks, well, since I can't convince my teacher through letters or discussion, I have no choice. But he won't write a whole volume, but he writes an article, 25-page article, sends it off to the Journal of Philosophy, a refutation of Professor Y's theory of the self, proving that, or arguing, contending that it has to be the case that the that which observes, that observer has no content at all. It's just a pure awareness. So how could you call that the self? What is the self must be something with features, with content, with substance. It must be something that has feelings, emotions, thoughts, volition. So there must be this just selfless or kind of empty awareness observing the true self, which is the changing content of the system. And so he publishes his journal, his paper gets it published in this highly esteemed Journal of Philosophy, and then he becomes acclaimed by all of these philosophers. Philosophers are now reading it and thinking, ah, brilliant, wonderful reputation of Professor Wise. And now Professor Z is the hero of the philosophers. Okay. Okay, and then finally we come to the sixth position, and this is the, what's called called the false-like view of self. This is the view of self. This is actually, I believe, here the Buddha is taking wording that was used in some of the, it could even be in some of the Upanishads, the way of expressing, at least some of these phrases come from the Upanishads, the ways of expressing the idea of self. Here it is the self of mind that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. This self of mind is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. This is called full-fledged, fully, full-blown, eternalistic view. Either way, I was going to say, now this is called a speculative view, the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views, fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not freed from birth, aging, and death, not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He is not freed from suffering, I say. Okay, maybe this should conclude our main presentation. Now, if there's any questions, any comments, please feel welcome. Statement, receiving not self with self, the way Professor White, this is the way I have to say, this is the way I'm interpreting it. It's not that there's an explanation of that in the sutras themselves. Even the commentaries don't really, I have to say, they don't do very good. They just use the theory of the aggregate, the rather artificial. So this is the way I would understand what's going on. Okay, one is reflecting on one's experience, reflecting on one's own mind. Okay, and so as one reflects, it's sort of like observing the mind, one sees constant changing content in the mind. And yet, it would seem that there's an something observing that kind of, they call it in the Vedanta theory, they call it the silent witness. Like something just hanging back there, witnessing what is going on. Yeah, actually in the Upanishads, there's this idea of, advice is to develop philosophy. There are two birds on a tree. One bird eats the sweet and bitter fruit. The other bird just remains on the branch, watching silently. That's probably the same idea that's being expressed here. And then that is interpreted, I don't remember whether it's interpreted in the Upanishad itself or by the commentators, that these are the two selves. There's the empirical self and the transcendental self. The empirical self is the self that eats the sweet and bitter fruit. That's the self that performs action, that engages in karma, and experiences the good and bad results. The bird that just watches silently, that is the true self, the oxygen, that is just there silently in the background, observing the empirical self, the finite self, undergo all of these experiences. And what one has to do, according to the Upanishad theory, is stop identifying with the bird that eats the sweet and bitter fruit. Stop identifying with the finite empirical self. Well, actually, in this theory, that is not, in this version, that is not the self. That is not the truth. One has to stop identifying with that. That is not the true self. And one has to shift one's sense of identity back to the silent bird. Shift one's sense of identity back to the true transcendental self. That's in the first theory. Exactly, yeah. This, yeah, actually, in the Amistad, they do speak about two souls, so I have to concede you are right. So you can speak about two souls, but I would prefer to see it as maybe one, maybe okay, you could say two souls, so the transcendental self watching the empirical self. That's in the first theory. In the second theory, one says the transcendental self is the true self. The empirical self, what's called the empirical self, is not the true self. In the third theory, they say that what is taken to be the transcendental self is not really a transcendental self. That's just, maybe just a function of the mind. And the true self is just this ever-changing bundle of perception, feeling, thought. Okay, I think there's another one. Yeah. That's the way I would understand it, too. Okay, just to clarify, the Buddha does speak about, he refers to himself sometimes in such and such a previous life, I was, or he was about because I was the wise rabbit, or he tells stories in such and such a past life, I was the Brahmin. Well, it wasn't just being done with this perplexity revolving around center of the around centering around this idea of I. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? I think it's that perplexity that surrounds these questions that is the problem. The perplexity and then the. And also the fact that all of these questions are centering around the idea of an I. The I is not yet brought out to be a self, but it's still sort of center point of the speculation. Not just taking the I in the as a convenient notion, but just a pointing device. Okay, we'll have time just for one question. Okay, so you know what I would say that you want to say deeper again? Maybe an asava is, let's just think about it. Yeah, probably that's why in the sutras, you, the nut, made into an asava, perhaps. Because yous are kind of more active role. But you is definitely included as the first of the 10 setters. Because actually first and third, the third setter is also a view. So whether views, I haven't come across a statement which says that asavas are cheaper than setters, but it might be the case. But the asavas seem to be, I call them the defilements in their most fundamental, the most primordial mode in which the defilements are. And setters do seem to be more, as a more active, more binding role. Whereas asavas, the idea of something which lies deep within and which comes flowing up to the surface from time to time. Whereas setter is something which is present in the mind and then keeps one in bondage. Certain setters, well, so to say the asavas keep all of the setters intact. Certain setters are direct, have direct counterparts among the asavas. But I think we'll deal with that next time, because we're going to deal with the abandoning of certain setters. Then we can discuss the relation of setters and asavas. And I think we have to stop now that the base is properly closed with the verse. Sadhe Deva Nimo
Sabra-sampati-se-vi-ya.